our political commentators this morning, Neil Jones and Bridget Morton. Kia ora korua.
Kia ora.
Neil was Chief of Staff to the Labour leader Jacinda Ardern. Prior to that, Chief of Staff to the then leader Andrew Little, is now Director of the public affairs firm Capital. Bridget Morton's a Director with public and commercial law firm Franks Ogilvie, a former ministerial advisor for the previous National led government, a National Party member, and who works during the elections volunteering for the party's deputy leader, Nicola Willis. Health system, we could pick any week of the year to talk about it, but RNZ and 9 to Noon specifically, also last week, right into this, RNZ's reporter Ruth Hill. The reporting that she is and others are doing currently suggests there are a lot of very unhappy people within the health system who are willing to start revealing some of what is going on. We've had the remnants of the board go. We've got a commissioner in. Do we have a health minister driving this, Bridget, do you think? Or is the health minister... are these decisions being made by others? What is going on?
I think there's absolutely being cabinet decisions are driving this, and that is obviously led by the health minister and his associates. I don't think there's frankly any question of that. You can see that this is leadership by the top, those things you just mentioned, the board, a commissioner, and it seems very strongly, you would have seen in the reaction to the, as you say, multiple health stories that there have been over the last week, that the commissioner is very much in charge and very much leading that work. I mean, we've always discussed with health that that is, we've got to be careful putting the operational side of it, and I think you're seeing that come through.
You had the commissioner who's in charge emailing every single person who works in the health system to say that the chief executive of Health New Zealand, Te Whata Ora, and a meeting of senior people there were heading in a completely different direction to what he was wanting.
And we I don't think that's accurate. I think
Let's break through.
He did use the word sabotage.
Stop. I want to explain. The document that was leaked to the media that talked about saving $700 million by losing X number of nurses, specialists and so forth. To be clear, that kind of analysis is not a first. Does that happen quite regularly, this kind of... what it might take to meet a budget. Can you explain?
So, there was a PowerPoint put up in a meeting in which the chief executive was present. That seems to be one of the issues, is the fact that it was done by somebody senior, it was put up, and there was no interjection when it did go up to say, hey, this is absolutely not the direction of travel that we've talked about. We've absolutely said this is not frontline. And therefore, he had to come out. And I think this is what I'm showing in terms of like strong leadership. But he came out really strongly and said, that's absolutely not what we're doing. I'm reassuring you that's not what we're doing. Making it super clear. Obviously very uncomfortable for the chief executive, but I think she has to take that responsibility on.
But was that document, is that a pro forma kind of spreadsheet analysis that gets done regularly and doesn't necessarily mean implementation?
No, I think you get the analogies made. So people go, well, you know, if we're going to cut $200,000 out of a particular budget line, what does it mean in terms of FTEs if we're cutting jobs? But what was wrong about this, and it's very clear that it was wrong, is that that is not where they're looking for budget savings.
Who's they, though?
Well, that's the Ministry of Health. The Chief Executive has reaffirmed it. The Commissioner has been very clear. The Minister has been very clear. I don't really see how you don't see it getting any clearer that that is absolutely not what they're doing, because somebody put it on a PowerPoint. And as I think Neil's going to say, he used the word sabotage. What he actually said was, it could be sabotage, it could be incompetence, it could be all of the things. Frankly, he doesn't care. And that, I think, is absolutely the right response.
Look, it wouldn't be the first time the health bureaucracy has kind of gone in its own direction, astray from what the political direction was. I think all of this is symptoms, though, of the actual problem, which is that we have a health system which is underfunded. And so, as I've banged on endlessly on the show for years, the only way National was going to pay for its tax cuts was by cutting into social services. And this is what we're seeing. So we see this big announcement of a $1.4 billion a year deficit in health. It's a blowout. The whole thing's going to fall over. They don't mention that was basically told to the Health Select Committee back in March before the budget. In the budget in 2024, the ASMS, the NZNO and the CTU have done analysis showing that when you look at inflation, demographic change like ageing population and population growth, the 2024 budget had about a 4% reduction in real per capita spending, which means there is less money for each person in the health system. And so it's no surprise that we find that there are, the health system is spending more money than it has because it's trying to maintain the services it's got. So all of this, you know, there's a political imperative to say we're not going to cut the front line. And I believe people are genuine. I believe Shane Ritty is genuine. I believe Lester Levy is genuine. The problem is, I don't know how you cut $1.4 billion without cutting the front line. And it seems that that PowerPoint was probably a good faith effort by someone in the health system to say, how do we start to do this? You're not going to do it by cutting back the budget for pens or, you know, laying off a few comm staff. This is doctors, it's nurses, it's frontline services. And at the same time, we've got a denial, there's a hiring freeze. And I understand there is no hiring freeze. It's just people aren't able to advertise certain jobs. And so you hear that Wairarapa Hospital has 40 nurses short. Bay of Plenty Hospital is turning away patients because they don't have enough doctors. GP clinics around the country have been told by Shane Ritty, said an NZ doctor, there's not enough money, you'll have to put up your fees. I got a letter from my GP practice in Island Bay saying that. So this is all, these are all symptoms of a lack of funding to fund other priorities. And I think people are trying to save frontline services, but it doesn't add up.
I think one of the issues, though, is that blaming entirely on funding actually completely misunderstands the structural issues that we have. And, you know, Labor did try in terms of centralising and getting, you know, rid of the sort of DHB structure, that this was meant to get rid of some of those costs that were being repeated through multiple different streams, as well as, you know, stopping that sort of postcode lottery. But I think we can't say that if we just put more money in, it's going to solve it. We actually just don't have those doctors and we don't have those nurses. So you've got to look at it more holistically. You've got to go, well, what about immigration settings? What are we actually doing in terms of getting people through medical school and getting through nursing school and the support?
We've been told that they've overhired nurses, apparently. The recruitment has been so successful, right?
But then we have Wairarapa Hospital doesn't have enough nurses. I mean, none of this makes any sense. This is the problem. You know, we every day we hear these news stories that don't make sense with the official narrative. So something isn't adding up here. And Bridget's right. You know, I have no doubt that there are inefficiencies in Te Whatu Ora. You know, I'm sure there will be. I'm sure there are lots of examples people could point to and say, this is inefficient or this spending shouldn't happen. My point is, when you go to that high level of $1.4 billion a year, that's more than just a few inefficiencies. That's actual services. That's a huge amount of money. And We're living in a sense of denial here, that we say, oh, we don't want to put more money into health, it costs so much money. Either we do keep up with inflation, ageing population and population growth, or we don't. And if we don't, this is what it looks like.
See, I'm curious about the move to put the commissioner in. And let's face it, most of the board had resigned, including former National, highly regarded former National MP, among others. A former head of IRD who led the most successful computer project I think this country's ever had without a hitch. All these people apparently weren't asking the right questions or weren't being told the right things. I think the Prime Minister admitted back in October he knew the scale of this, did he not? So I'm confused as to how these people on that board chose to resign in advance of the Commissioner coming in, and how the Commissioner is the answer to this, Bridget. What is the strategy? Is it the Beehive wanting essentially to be as close to decision making as you can humanly be?
I think there is an element of that absolutely happening here because of the fact that, as you say, these challenges are so large. There is frankly, you know, in terms of there has to be put more money in, I think that's, you know, they're aware of that. They've, you know, operationally increased funding every year. But what has to happen is that they have to change some of these settings that has stopped the kind of the waste that's flowing through. And I think absolutely the camera's gone, they've lost trust in the leadership, and they have gone, okay, we need to actually have direct control. And you've seen that Kāinga Ora as well. You've seen it where there's these big cost blowouts. They go, we actually can't trust what is coming to us. Therefore, they have that sense. Like, is that the right thing to do politically? Possibly not, because they've taken it completely on their shoulders to fix it. They've got no one else to blame. They've only got themselves. So they are taking a high-risk strategy, but I think that shows that they are really aware of the risk and the problems that they've got, because we know that this is not a 3 or 4 year problem. This is an aging population problem that is going to hit us really, really hard.
And I think this is a serious political risk for the government. I think if I was to look at all of the issues around at the moment, if I was in the Prime Minister's office, this would be my number one concern, because it's a real issue that goes to people's core services, their ability to get treatment when they need it. It's a hip pocket issue, and it's a competence issue, and it's a priorities issue. And so I think they need to find a way through it. And that probably is going to mean the next budget increasing the health budget, because I just don't think there's a way through that doesn't involve keeping pace with cost pressures.
Okay. Similarly, Whakaha, which was, of course, the ministry specifically set up after many years of campaigning from the disability communities, plural. Now, its responsibility for support services to be rolled back to the Ministry of Social Development. We know we had that controversy, that freeze on the independent funding system that came in, the sudden revelation again of a supposed cost blowout. What are the political risks here, Bridget? And you know, this is rolling back years of campaigning. But what is the decision-making behind this move?
I think it's a panic button decision-making, I think. If you look at Martin Weaver's report, essentially the way that it was set up was that it was set up to fail. You look at the details, there's incredible cost blowouts because it appears that there's none of the same financial controls that exist in all other government departments, including, I think, I can't remember the exact quotes, I'm not going to say correct, but along the lines of that the leadership weren't sort of cognizant that cost blowouts actually had legal consequences as well as financial consequences. I don't think, you know, it makes it very, really clear that they were not set up in a way that they actually could be the commissioning agent that they were meant to be. And so my initial reaction to this announcement was, well, oh, we're just moving the deck chairs again by moving this part, the commissioning part, to MSD. But actually, when you look at it, it's going to take a long time to get the department up to scratch so that they actually could be a commissioning agent and do it properly and do a service to communities with disabilities. So in the meantime, and it is permanent, so it's not in the meantime, but they actually, to arrest and get this funding sorted, they actually have to give it to someone that actually knows, frankly, what they're doing.
But do they? Because we had correspondence during this whole very, very impassioned debate saying the same people essentially moved from one government department to a new government department. Will the same people move back? Where is this expertise of which you're speaking? Or again, is this a case where the model is not funded to deliver what the model is supposed to deliver?
There's a few things here. I mean, this Whakaha was only set up in 2022, so this is a new department. There were always going to be teething errors. My understanding is there's a huge amount of IT trouble with bringing together MSD and health data, for example. So it was always going to be a bit of a rocky start. My understanding is the Martin Weaver's report. I've been told by people in the sector that they were trying to feed into that and were ignored. They feel that report didn't listen to the people who were actually involved in the sector. And I think another thing to be aware of is that there has always been cost overruns in disability support. Every finance minister ends up topping up disability support because there are always overruns. I don't think we should be that surprised by that. This is a growing area of need, particularly with autism. There's a growing amount of people who are being diagnosed and who need support. So I think this shouldn't be too surprising. I know that for the disability community, the loss of that commissioning power in Whakaha is a huge blow to them. They spent decades campaigning for that. For them, it's a big issue about nothing about us without us, and they wanted to be able
to... Where does it leave Enabling Good Lives, gave power and decision-making power to people themselves?
So that's basically been paused, is my understanding. Enabling Good Lives actually gives autonomy to disabled people and their families to be able to manage their own funds and not be, you know, not have to go through a bureaucratic process to receive them. I think the most concerning thing, though, that has kind of been missed out of this discussion is that there has been a freeze on the disability providers' funding, which, if that remains, you know, wage increases wages have to go up, there have to be increases. That means that ultimately providers are going to have to cut services, turn away clients. So that's where I think it'll be felt. I think the reshuffling of the department will you know, anger people in the community, but this will have a real impact on people's lives.
This comes in a tight fiscal environment, as we know, and we can relitigate again the decisions that a coalition government made in its budget, Bridget. But the political consequences come where and how? Will it be just a stream of endless headlines of a negative kind?
Yeah, I think so. And I absolutely agree that I think the biggest pressure is going to be in the fact that they have put those funding freezes in place, because we know that cost pressures have gone up across the board, and that does mean that, you know, you will have providers who are having to make some really difficult decisions about who and what they provide to people. I think there is absolute political risk with this. I mean, it is a massive decision to have turned around something that the community has advocated for, as you say, for a decade, and take away some of that autonomy. I think it is disappointing that they have paused work on enabling good lives, because I do think that is a structural change that actually shows that we're actually progressing as a country and acknowledging that people with disabilities aren't people just to provide support to, but actually people who should be empowered to make their own decisions. So I think that is where some of the biggest risk is, because at the moment what they've just said is basically no, 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 back, 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 without giving any sort of hope that things are actually going to change.
And I could be wrong here, I think Enabling Good Lives was brought in by the previous national government initially. And so they are not just turning back the previous government's legacy, but their own.
Let's talk about the traffic light system being introduced for people on benefits, specifically JobSeeker, I think, is it? Box ticking, sticking to theme, intended to save some more money, Bridget? What's the purpose of this?
I think there's absolutely a narrative about what you would expect from a centre-right government, that people who get support from the state have obligations to the state. I think that's completely on board with what National came in with. You saw that first happening in sort of public housing waitlists, in terms of, you know, people who were abusing the sort of properties and abusing their neighbours and things were not seen, you know, were not able to continue in their tenancies. So I think you're seeing an extension of this. But what I see that is different to previous announcements or rhetoric from centre-right governments in New Zealand about this is this traffic light system. This is not a straight, you know, one thing wrong, sanction the next day. This is a tiered system, has got much more understanding and flexibility built into it. The proof will be in the pudding, of course, about how that actually is operationalised. But I do think you see progress in that they acknowledge that for some people, there are greater barriers to getting jobs than for others.
I think it's kind of a mistake to see it as a good faith policy argument, because there is no evidence that this kind of sanction does anything. Now, I'm not a no obligations kind of guy, and I don't think any mainstream party says no obligations, maybe the Greens. But I think what you see is, as you ratchet up the sanctions and you make it easier to fall afoul, the reality is people will fall off the system. And you can imagine when people, it's easy to say we'll just do the right thing, but when people are at their lowest and they're really struggling, you can see how you miss an email or you fail to make an appointment. It's a bit like, you know, you look at things like, say, voter registration. You say, well, just have ID, just register in advance. But we know the more hoops you put in, the fewer people vote. It's the same with benefits. And so what this leads to is more people in poverty, more people falling off the rails. And the reason it works is one is to save money. But I think politically it works for the government because, and I've sat in more focus groups than a lot of people have had hot meals. And I'll tell you, there is a certain swing voter who you sort of give them an itch to scratch around beneficiaries. And there's a sense that, oh, well, they're really only there because they're irresponsible and they're lazy and we need to keep them in line. And this works very well politically. People vote for you as a result of it. But it also helps to, I think, give, at a time of rising unemployment, to moralise unemployment. And we saw the PM this last week saying, well, there's lots of great jobs out there. You know, maybe unemployed people could try being a digger. That's a cool, driving a digger, that's a cool job. Well, the reality is there are 6,000 fewer jobs in building construction than when the government took power. You know, people aren't unemployed. They're not on benefits because of a moral failure. They're there because of vast impersonal forces. Yeah. And so I think this is cynical. I think it's cowardly politics. I mean, I grew up in a benefit household with a single parent, so I probably take this more personally than most. But I think leadership is actually about bringing people together and with you. I think it'll work for them, but I think it's deeply cynical.
The Prime Minister has been to Canberra. The 501 perennial telling off happened. Yet to see the policy overturned again. I think it was for about 5 seconds, wasn't it, under the new Labour government. I think the immigration minister quickly reversed what seemed to be a softening on that. And then there's this, whatever pillar two of AUKUS actually is, Bridget, this kind of softening up does seem to continue in speeches.
In terms of the 501s, it is obviously the biggest issue that I think most people understand, because we do know we have got rising crime and increased gang membership, etc. And 501s are a direct feeder into that. Really interesting, I think, to watch the late Australia's Prime Minister Albanese really sort of do a very delicate tightrope dance around 501s, because officially they have U-turned. And, you know, now 501s can be deported in the same way they were sort of a year ago. But I think I was reading, it was Newsroom this morning, was indicating that the numbers since that U-turn have actually not changed. So it does appear there might be a
common sense. Talking out both sides of your mouth, indeed. Not in a wink.
Which, frankly, I'm okay with, as long as there's not an increase to 501s coming into New Zealand. Albanese can deal with his politics however he wishes. On the defence stuff, I think you've seen repeated calls from Australia that New Zealand needs to pay a bigger dividend in terms of security in the region. And I think you see that reflected. Luxembourg's speech was very strong on that building that. This being his third trip, I think, to, you know, see the Australians since he was elected in sort of, you know, 8 months. It's pretty, you know, that's a lot of sort of rhetoric back and forth.
Yes, but Ukraine could happen in the South Pacific. I mean, yes, obviously there is a risk of conflict in the South China Sea, but a little melodramatic or...
No, I think it's actually acknowledging the fact that we, I think, for a long time have gone, we're fine down the bottom here, in the bottom of the world, we, you know, everyone likes us, we're okay. Actually,
talking about isolation was another reference.
Yeah, speaking about the fact that actually we do need to play a bigger part, and that if we do want to have the reciprocal agreements, then that is something that we actually have to invest in. So, you know, you're starting to see Luxon also talking about the fact that is likely to mean, I think, increased defence spending domestically as well.
Yeah, look, I on the 501s, I agree with Bridget that I think any New Zealand Prime Minister will struggle to overcome the domestic politics of Australia, which is they want them out. And maybe if there's a sort of, you know, a bit of a wink and a smile and Albo says what he needs to say and the numbers decrease, that's fine. On the whole AUKUS issue, it is clear that Luxon is ramping up the rhetoric. I mean, in a sense, he's right. We are in an increasingly dangerous geopolitical environment. There are increasing threats in the Pacific, or the Indo-Pacific, as we're now supposed to call it. But, you know, I think the big problem is, there, regardless of all this, we still don't really know what AUKUS Pillar 2 is. We still have a very uncertain outcome of the US election, which, you know, as I've said before, I think they are an unreliable ally. And we still have a third of our trade going to China. So there is a lot more water going under the bridge, I think, before we get more entangled with the US.
The OCR was cut last week. I won't relitigate the various commentaries on the Reserve Bank and its previous indications and how quickly things have turned around. Now things are focusing on whether this incumbent government's going to luck out in terms of a series of rate cuts and possible economic recovery. Bridget.
Yeah, I mean, if you took last week's announcements, you'd be thinking that that's looking pretty good for a second term of government, given that we know that most people will vote on the basis of whether or not they feel better off as sort of a family or as a household than they did at the last election. And last election was a lot about was the cost of living election. And so there is all of those pointers to it being in a better space. Obviously, the problem is we're still quite far out from the election and people have short memories. And so for them, they've got to make sure that there is continued growth, that unemployment that Neil was talking about before, you know, is start to brought down, that people do feel like there's a possibility of getting jobs, that they do have a bit more hope and optimism in that space. But I do think, and they should be, you know, slapping themselves on the back last week. It was exactly what they said that they would do. It is having results, and therefore they should be...
Who should be slapping themselves on the back?
Well, I think... Look, I've got to give credit both to the Reserve Bank and to the government.
We've had an enforced recession for the past 2 years. That's why we're having an interest rate
I don't blame National for taking credit. Anyone would take credit for it. But let's be clear what's happened. The Reserve Bank ramped up interest rates, crashed the economy. It's crashed faster than we thought, and they've quickly reversed course. The Reserve Bank itself said we don't know what the impact the government's cuts to public spending or its tax cuts will have yet. This is about the economy crashing faster than we thought. I don't think National's going to take credit for that. But I think you're right on the politics, which is that my view for a while has been the most likely scenario in 2026, is that we have low inflation, we have low interest rates, we have a return to growth, and Christopher Luxon and Nicola Willis get to go to the electorate and say, we promise to get you back on track, we've made some hard decisions, but we're back on track. I think keep on track might be their election slogan, and they'll point to a dangerous, scary Labour Party talking about wealth taxes and all kinds of things, and that'll be what the election is in their view.
Well, we could loop back to where we started, though. the state of the health system and its personal impact on many, many New Zealanders might be right up there.
Well, indeed. But I think it is a reminder for the Labour Party that they can't rely on this government to sort of knock itself out of power, because I think the economic tide is likely to be in the government's favour. They're going to have to find issues and work really hard to pin the government down on them.
Neil Jones, Bridget Morton, thank you very much.